The show you have selected will start directly after the next message.
Are you unhappy with your health and catch everything doing the rounds? Do you have a mystery illness the doctors can't treat? Are you searching for a better way to manage your health? My name is Kevin Davis. Our bioresonance system starts with an automated full body scan. It's simply the quickest way to shine a light on what's going on inside, with treatments during the same session. For the latest health tech at the best price, visit biohealthtech.co.uk today and make us your first choice for a healthier you.
Hello, welcome to the Yes to Life show. I'm Robin Daly, the chairman and founder of the UK charity Yes to Life, that's been helping people with cancer to access integrative medicine for almost 15 years. Integrative medicine is all about combining the benefits of both conventional and complementary medicine. As such, it's not really happening in the UK yet. We certainly have nothing approaching the best examples of US cancer centres. But we do have one pioneering oncologist who has been an ardent advocate of lifestyle medicine for many years and who has integrated as many evidence-based lifestyle approaches as he can into his own clinic. This pioneering approach has made Professor Robert Thomas something of a Yes to Life legend, as he's definitely gone out on a limb to do his very best to improve the lot of people with cancer by breaking out of the conventional straitjacket of solely drug-based approaches. I'm talking to Professor Thomas over Skype at his home in North London about managing one of the most troubling symptoms that people with cancer experience. Hello, Professor Thomas. Thanks a lot for coming on the show today.
Thank you, Robin. It's always a pleasure.
Great. So today we're going to discuss a very specific topic, joint pain after cancer. Now, I can't say it's something I know very much about at all, but I'm interested to learn more. Consistent pain, particularly around bones and joints, can be seriously unpleasant, that's for sure. You've suggested this is something you'd like to talk about, and no doubt for some very good reasons that we're going to find out about today. So can you start right out by giving us an idea of the scale of the problem? Do you have any kind of figures to indicate how many people this affects?
Yes, Ron. Well, in the general population, about 10 million people suffer from what is called arthritis or joint pains.
Yes.
At any one time. So it's a big issue for the population. But of course, we're interested in the people who have been through cancer treatments. And a study which was performed amongst 800 patients who'd had cancer treatment and particularly had ongoing hormonal therapies asked what symptom bothered them the most.
Mm-hmm.
And we were quite surprised to see that 55% said that arthritis was one of the most troublesome side effects. And we actually published this data in the multidisciplinary conference in Adelaide last year. And it wasn't really a surprise to many of the oncologists and patients who were there, who sort of aware of what patients are going through, because it's reported a lot to oncologists that arthritis is a big problem for patients.
It clearly is. So, and just to be clear, this is a side effect of cancer or of cancer treatment?
Joint pains are usually a consequence of cancer treatments. You can get some tumours affecting joints like sarcomas and things. But for the sake of this interview, I think, should we concentrate on the medications which have precipitated an earlier onset or a more severe problem with joints?
Right. Okay. So maybe you can have a look at some of the causes now. Which treatments, you've already mentioned hormonal therapy, which treatments are possibly going to lead to joint pain, and do we know why?
Good questions. Now, there's a number of factors, obviously, which precipitate. We all get a degree of joint pains as well, so it's just the normal aging osteoarthritis is probably a significant cause. But The surgery can affect joints. You could have a reduced mobility around a joint, say if you've had axillary surgery for breast cancer. If you then go on to chemotherapy, the taxanes, taxotere and paclitaxel, cause joint pains in at least 70 or 80% of people. Wow. And they can be quite severe during the chemo. Usually they wear off, but the general level of arthritis is always a bit higher. The biggest factor is starting hormone therapies. Tamoxifen is reported in about 20% of people. Aromatase inhibitors for breast cancer, it's reported in over 60%. And if you're on androgen deprivation therapy, such as Zoladex for prostate cancer, it can affect up to 30, 40%. There's a lot of the biological treatments we're giving more and more in oncology now. In fact, you know, that's where it's going, is the biological treatments like these new treatments for ER-positive breast cancer, Afinitor, palbociclib, etc. They all have at least a 50% increased risk of joint pains getting worse. And these treatments you take for, you know, a long time now. I mean, AIs is recommended for 10 years.
Wow. So this is a major blight on your life, basically, if you're suffering from joint pain for 10 years. There's a huge number of treatments you've reeled off there that all have this common side effect. What's the thing linking them all together? Why do they all cause joint pain?
That's a good question, actually, why they cause joint pains. A lot of the immunotherapy drugs, you know, which try to recruit the immunity to attack cancer cells, commonly cause... Well, the innate immunity, when you have a cold, for example, you always feel a bit stiff in the joints, yes, and a bit worn down, isn't it? And that's because of a triggering of the innate immunity. So that's how they cause it. With the hormone therapies, it's less known. So they can cause a bit of weight gain, and weight gain is associated with increased joint pains.
Okay.
But a lot of the joint pains you get in the fingers, for example, which isn't really related to weight. Weight is more normally the larger joints, like the hips and the lower back.
Yes.
So it's largely unknown, to be honest, Robin, why it causes the joint pains.
Hmm. Okay, well, an important question. Are we looking at permanent damage, or is this something that literally lasts while you're having the treatment?
Well, it's a combination of both. For example, if you have someone who's had taxotere chemotherapy, then had to go on to an aromatase inhibitor, and then maybe an immunotherapy like Herceptin, inevitably the joint pains start within 3 months or so, and will continue for the duration of that treatment, and often get worse. A lot of patients, when they stop, or some people stop because the joint pains are so unbearable.
Wow. Right.
They never say that their joint pain has gone back to where it was pre-treatment.
Right.
They're always at a worse state, but usually better when you stop the treatment.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, you know, you're painting a pretty grim picture. It's obviously hugely widespread because these are the most common treatments that people for some of the most common cancers you're talking about. And I can see why it's a major issue that needs addressing.
Yes, it's been, you know, it's one of those things which has been largely overlooked. Mm. With the increase in interest in survivorship, it is coming through as a symptom which we should try to address.
Yes.
But, you know, most people are just told to sort of grin and bear it. And, you know, it's a major factor affecting their quality of life, which is obviously, as you know, is important. But not just on a daily basis of feeling a bit worse. It stops people doing things. You know, if you play a musical instrument or you need manual dexterity, it can affect that. The other trial we did recently with some medical students from Cambridge University is we interviewed 200 patients of why they weren't exercising as much as they ought to, because a lot of patients know that exercise is good for them.
Yes.
But when the one of the most common answers was because I've got joint pains, which you caused with your drugs. So it's our fault that they're not exercising. And as you know, exercise has a multitude of benefits for the patient. It improves the quality of life, reduces depression, improves mood, reduces weight, and probably reduces the risk of their cancer coming back. There's serious knock-on effects to joint pain, which is not being addressed.
Yes. Yeah. Clearly. Okay, so setting aside the creative solutions that I anticipate we're going to talk about in a while, what are the conventional solutions to the problem?
If you go to your doctor, GP with arthritis-like symptoms, first of all is to try and diagnose the cause of your arthritis. It's roughly split up into osteoarthritis and rheumatoid arthritis. But you can get other things like arthritis related to psoriasis and autoimmune diseases. So, the doctor will usually do some tests to find out which one it is. The vast majority are osteoarthritis, which is the sort of wear and tear type arthritis. And for that, most GPs these days would recommend a program of weight loss if that was an issue. But pretty quickly go on to non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, which can increase the risk of heart attacks and kidney disease and indigestion. Then more serious painkillers if needed, such as opiates, which are obviously have a lot of long-term issues. And then if necessary, refer to physiotherapy. And if that fails, orthopedic surgeons for, joint replacement. So that's the traditional route.
Right. Okay. So just want to pick up on a few things you said there. You explained what osteoarthritis is, the wear and tear. What's the rheumatoid arthritis? What's the difference?
We think that osteoarthritis is a sort of degenerative chronic inflammatory condition which attacks joints.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just wear and tear, in my opinion, because it usually happens in all the joints simultaneously. So it's a systemic disease.
Okay.
Almost certainly relates to chronic inflammation, which we can talk about later. Rheumatoid is a specific autoimmune disease where your body, for some reason, thinks your cartilage is a foreign body and sends out rheumatoid factors to kill it. Uh-huh. And therefore, it is a severe form of arthritis, which has got its own treatment. But for osteo, what actually happens is the cartilage degenerates, and then eventually you get sort of bone rubbing on bone and sort of pain and swelling and stiffness. But none of the treatments I've just mentioned address the fundamental disease process of osteoarthritis. They all just address the symptoms and dealing with the consequence of it, rather than preventing progression of the arthritis.
Right. Okay, so that's very important. So, as you say, these are the things that are on offer are largely to deal with the pain, we're all very grateful for when we need it. As you pointed to, there are long-term problems with opiates, particularly, which have been in the news a lot lately. Do you want to just say what's happened in the area of opiates in the last few years?
Most GPs would only use opiates at a last resort when a patient's in particular pain, maybe if they're waiting for an operation or something. Notwithstanding the addictive element, there's a lot of criticism of the makers of oral opiates that, they are a gateway to people becoming heroin addicts. I pretty much dispute that. I mean, they are prescribed by doctors and they're controlled drugs. So, it's can't really blame the company who's making a painkiller which works. if it's been prescribed inappropriately. But nevertheless, it, you know, long-term opioids can cause itching, cognitive functions, or reduce memory, possibly leading to an increased risk of dementia, constipation, and all sorts. So they're not pleasant drugs to be on.
No.
But, you know, if you're in severe pain, sometimes you have no other choice.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I have one personal experience of these in the kind of early days when OxyContin was doing the rounds and was touted as the greatest, latest thing. And clearly, at that time, there was what I would describe as an unhealthy relationship between the marketing department of the company making the stuff and the doctors, because the chief surgeon of the Middlesex Hospital announced that, you know, I was actually helping my daughter, and she was having the most horrendous side effects, as I found out they were, of coming off OxyContin. And he just said, no, ridiculous, there aren't any. Well, I didn't have to look very far on the internet to find out just how bad it was, but he wasn't looking on the internet, he was listening to the salesman, clearly. That kind of story, if you like, put out by a marketing department is quite damaging, I think, if it's being listened to too exclusively by the medical staff.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know the exact details of the case. I mean, need to look at the marketing literature from 10 years ago. There is a criticism that they underemphasized the addictive nature. And, you know, I've come across friends and relatives who are really sort of addicted to these, you know, not just OxyContin, Tramadol and all these. And they end up, you know, getting more problems from that.
Right.
No, they are very addictive, and they're very much a last resort as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, yeah. All right, anyway, it's just good to raise awareness of these things, I think, so that less people end up in this horrendous situation.
Absolutely.
Okay, so traditionally, I think the kind of attitude towards treatment-related side effects is something like, well, we're saving your life now, we'll deal with problems like this later if we need to. You know, it's all been about heroic life-saving, and quality of life hasn't traditionally been hugely on the radar. My thinking and the thinking of integrative medicine always goes something like, is there something we can do now that will mitigate or even avoid problems later? Some kind of protective therapy. Is there such a thing in this case that you know of, something that people can do just to actually stop it even happening?
I think we can break that patient that down a bit. So on the medical side, speaking from a doctor, we did a study actually in Bedford and Cambridge where we looked at switching from aromatase inhibitors to a different type. You know, if you're on, say, Rimadex, switching to Femara or maybe back to tamoxifen. And there was a group of people who did better.
Right.
Switching to a different brand of aromatase inhibitor. So it might be worth discussing with a GP. We often switch people over to aromatase inhibitors instead of tamoxifen because it's marginally more effective. But if the choice was to stop hormones altogether or go back to tamoxifen, quite often we say, well, just go back to tamoxifen, you know. And don't just accept the first advice from the doctor. You know, you were taking an aromatase inhibitor and that's it or nothing.
Right. Right.
So that's from the medical side.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, you know, in the short term, you might have to consider painkillers, but, you know, that's not something you'd want for, you know, 10 years on treatment.
No.
But in terms of the lifestyle, well, we know that osteoarthritis, for example, is related to a number of lifestyle factors, in addition to, you know, family history, which you can't do anything about. We know they're related to pro-inflammatory foods, such as, you know, burnt meats, processed meats, you know, foods with lots of sort of chemicals and preservatives, etc. High meat intake, smoking, low polyphenol-rich foods, or foods with a strong color, smell, and flavor. You know, fruit and vegetables, herbs, poor gut health, and then eating too much processed sugar, too much alcohol, being overweight. So all these factors you could sort of address for each individual. So you need to see what their lifestyle is, what the issues are in their diet. And of course, exercise and stretching is one of the most effective ways to help prevent joint progression.
Right. So that's quite an interesting one, because you're actually saying, rather than arriving at the point where you can't exercise because of the joint pain, do the exercise first and you won't get it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit of a chicken and egg situation. Yes. If you've got the joint pains, it's hard to exercise. But,
yes,
you know, that's where maybe a supervised exercise professional will help to be able to guide a patient through exercises which gradually increase the sort of ability to stretch and exercise despite the pain. And once you break through the pain barrier, often in the long term the pain starts reducing, and there's lots of trials to show that you know, one of the best things for osteoarthritis is to stay as mobile as possible.
Right. Well, that's interesting. Okay, so there are good reasons then to find a way to begin to start exercising, even though it's difficult. And a supported approach is probably the best one.
It is, but you hit the nail on the head a minute ago. I mean, you know, most people, unfortunately, you know, they look for help and they've already got the problem. But
yes,
if you know that you're going to, you know, if someone's got cancer and they're going to have a biological treatment, a hormone, or one of the chemo agents, which is, you know, the vast majority of the treatments we give, if we know that well over half patients are going to get arthritis, it doesn't make sense to wait for it to happen before you do anything about it. There should be a preventative program in place. We're looking at diet and exercise, you know, before the onset of the arthritis, because once the arthritis, although in the early stages it might just be a pain and stiffness, but once it sets in, you start getting cartilage degeneration and things, it's hard to then go back. So you're right, what we're looking at in our unit is a preventative program to start when people don't have joint pains.
Fantastic. Well, okay, I want to talk about that a little bit more later on, if we can. We'll come back to your preventive program. So can I just ask now, I mean, you reeled off a whole list of things, including exercise there, which you feel are helpful to preventing or reducing this kind of inflammation. Which of those do you find are the most effective, and are there different ones for different types of condition?
Well, if we stick to the most common type of arthritis, osteoarthritis, which is we don't really know what type of arthritis people with cancer get more often. It's probably a combination of osteo with a little bit of rheumatoid thrown in, but nevertheless, the lifestyle factors apply for all of them.
Mm-hmm.
So of the things I've just mentioned, stretching and exercise is definitely number one.
Yeah.
It depends what joint is affected. If it's your knees and your hips and lower back and you're overweight, of course, losing weight would be a great benefit.
Right.
But for the other thing is to generally reduce chronic inflammation, which, as you know, affects virtually everything, you know, from mood, dementia, risk of heart disease, high cholesterol, blood pressure, etc., as well as joint pains. And just going through them in detail, we know that if you eat a lot of meat, if you eat cured meat, if you eat meat which has been burnt with lots of aromatic amines on, these very much generate an inflammatory state in your body, which affects the joints.
Right.
As you know, I'm a big keen advocate of polyphenols, which are, as I just said, they give its color, its smell, and its taste. And you get these in fruit, vegetables, herbs, spices. And they have a number of features. First of all, they act as antidotes to pro-inflammatory foods, so they're a direct antidote to those. They have anti-inflammatory properties of their own, but more importantly, they actually affect the processes of joint damage, which I will just for you now. So I've just mentioned the anti-inflammatory, they're antioxidant, so a lot of the damage within joints are due to oxidative damage, so, you know, chemicals in our foods or environment which somehow get caught up in the joint matrix, and then the body sort of tries to kill them, so the cartilage gets damages a bystander effect, they actually can directly stop the chondrocytes, which are the cells which make cartilage, from destroying themselves when they, you know, in the process of arthritis. And they can affect this enzyme, metalloproteinase, which is the thing which encourages cartilage to be formed. So and it can stimulate that. So the difference between sort of polyphenol-rich foods and, say, painkillers is they actually affect the fundamental cause of arthritis.
Right.
So they were the type of, so we know that populations who eat those foods, lots of sort of tea, herbs, spices, etc., over long periods of their life, have a much lower incidence of arthritis compared to a typical Western diet, for example. The big question is, of course, if you already have arthritis, can you change to a polyphenol-rich diet and prevent further progression, or even, you know, get some healing of the joints, which is more difficult to prove.
Well, that's really interesting. I mean, in addition to the fact that it's actually addressing the root cause, you get a kind of double whammy there you described, whereby it's clearing up the mess a bit, it's stopping the process a bit, but it's also encouraging good, healthy growth as well. So it's a really great solution, isn't it?
It is, and probably if you've got, you know, early arthritis, if you know as well as all the other things we just said, you know, if you switch to a very polyphenol-rich diet, you probably would slow the process or even stop it in its tracks. But what we, as part of our program to help patients, what we're saying is, you know, if you get in as part of a lifestyle strategy, if you increase your polyphenols when you know shortly after the main radical treatments, before the arthritis sets in, hopefully that will stop the arthritis forming.
The other great bonus, of course, is that you know, all the things you've actually just advocated for your joints, they're fantastic if you happen to have cancer as well, of course. So you know, no negatives really.
Well, that's the difference, isn't it, between what you're advocating for Yes to Life and what we're trying to advocate is all the things we just mentioned are good for you.
Right.
You know, not only for cancer, for heart disease, cholesterol, dementia, whereas, although, you know, I'm not saying we don't need medical treatments, of course, I take anti-inflammatories from time to time,
right,
but, you know, they tend to have bad side effects, like, you know, damaging your kidneys, your heart, and giving you indigestion. So it's an all-win situation if you change to an intensive lifestyle strategy.
Now, I imagine there's a case for a bit of combination here as well, because of course, you know, for example, that we were talking about somebody who's already suffering pain, but you want to get back on an exercise program. Well, some good old painkillers could just help with that, couldn't they?
Absolutely. What tends to happen, in my experience, is you know, you wouldn't tell someone to stop the painkiller straight away, and as you say, they might facilitate an exercise program at the beginning. But gradually, over time, what tends to happen is they slowly start knocking off the painkillers, and they're able to exercise without needing them. You've got to be a little bit careful also when you exercise with non-steroidals, because they can, you know, especially if you get dehydrated, because it can increase the risk of renal failure. In fact, you know, that was a mistake I made 15 years ago when I ran the London Marathon, and I took a Voltarol before, and then I had high blood pressure for 18 months, which is now settled, and it's well known now that you shouldn't be combining non-steroidals with exercise, you know, unless absolutely necessary. So in the short term, yes, but if you're going to do anything which gets you very dehydrated, I would try and avoid a non-steroidal,
right,
and try to do other things before, you know, like what I advise is to get some fresh ginger, grate that, and, you know, have that as a drink maybe an hour before exercise, you know, mix that with some turmeric, you know, and that can often have a similar effect.
Right. Fantastic. So I wonder if you've got any examples of people who you've, through one of your lifestyle consultations and recommendations, you feel you've helped enormously in addressing these kind of problems. Have you got any stories?
I mean, hundreds. A classic example is someone who, a lady comes with me, there was one last month. She had no positive breast cancer, so, you know, not a pleasant cancer, and a 40% chance of relapse within 10 years, so didn't really want to compromise on her adjuvant medical treatments.
Right.
But she was really suffering with joint pains and was on anti-inflammatories, getting indigestion, etc. So we did a number of things. We referred her to a personal trainer who was very good, who'd had a bit of training in exercise, in cancer rehabilitation as well. We went through the diet, and she took a lot of processed sugar, particularly in the morning. She was having sugary cereals. We cut that out. And generally sort of cleaned up the diet, trying to avoid carcinogens, etc. But then we tried to increase her polyphenol intake with fruit and veg. And she ended up starting to take the polyphenol supplement POMI-T, which we've talked about previously. And it's got four polyphenol-rich foods. Because she, in her lifestyle, that suited her. I'm not saying you would take a supplement in all cases, but she was a busy manager in a GP's practice, so she took some with her breakfast and her lunch. And within 3 months, she was absolutely fine. She was going to stop the AI if it didn't work.
Right.
And she says she still had a little bit of joint pains, but she was substantially better. And now she's continuing to take these drugs, which will reduce the risk of relapse by a further 15%. So that, you know, it would be a shame if she was to have stopped them.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So basically, that's gone from a kind of life inhibiting side effect to something that's in the background and allows her to carry on with her life.
Yeah, but you know, with a bit of effort.
Yeah.
These things are all good for you in other ways as well. So probably help to reduce the, well, not only do the polyphenols probably have a reduction in risk of cancer, but allowing you to exercise is even greater benefit.
Yeah. Yeah. Fantastic. All right. So, given everything you've told us about the fact there are so many things you can do to alleviate this horrible symptom, and they're all non-toxic, why aren't these approaches being used in every oncology department?
Good question. I mean, there are some survivorship programs popping up more now across the country. So I know the Genesis Care in Milton Keynes have a good survivorship program now. But you know, they're coming through slowly, and hospital managers strapped for cash, they always look at these programs as a way to sort of in a short-term gain stop funding them, which is always sad because, as you know, the cost effectiveness is, they probably come out massively on top.
That doesn't make sense.
It's all a bit, you know, it does need more evidence to convince some doctors. I mean, the evidence for gut health is that's the other factor I didn't mention a minute ago, try to improve gut health. Is 10 years ago, you were all thought to be sort of a little bit on the quacky side if you talked about gut health. Now, you know, the president of ASCO, the world's biggest cancer conference, the CRUK, both said that it's the highest priority for one of the highest priorities for research this year.
Amazing.
Because if you have healthy gut health, not only the patient is less likely to have dementia, fatigue, arthritis, they actually, these new biological drugs are more likely to work because they recruit the immune system to fight cancer. So suddenly gut health has become very, very mainstream.
Mm.
You could argue, if you had your conspiracy theory hat on, that, of course,
never.
Drug companies make a drug for £100,000 a year, And they've discovered that if someone has a healthy gut, they get a 25% increased chance of response. They get a 25% increased profit. So suddenly there's a lot of drive from all sorts of quarters to improve the health of patients.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm being cynical. Ways to improve gut health, as you know, would be to eat bacteria-rich foods.
Yes.
To polyphenol-rich foods, which are actually prebiotics as well. So things like what I've already mentioned, but also mushrooms, beans. These are all good prebiotics. Mm. And in my opinion, if you've had some antibiotics or chemotherapy, or you've been ill for a while, I would take a good probiotic supplement for a short period of time to try and aid gut health. Although, we need more research in that area.
Right. Okay, very important. So just to come back to your clinic, you're actually doing these kind of lifestyle assessments on your patients, which they're lucky people. Everybody should clearly be getting one. But does that mean that you're able to prescribe things for them, which are lifestyle medicine, or do people have to pay for themselves?
Good question. We have managed to get the 12-week exercise referral for cancer in our area. And there is some funding for exercise professionals to do a level 4 course in exercise rehab. So, and if you don't have to pay much at all to go on to that 12-week program.
Okay.
So that's good. No, outside that, no, I'm afraid. Well, a lot of this is about, what foods you buy. And people say that healthy foods are more expensive. I disagree. I think if you go down to the market on a Saturday evening, you can get a bucket full of fruit and veg for next to nothing, whereas ready meals are more. But if you wanted to go on to, say, supplements, if you wanted to take, say, the POMI-T supplement or a probiotic supplement, I'm afraid you have to buy those because we can't prescribe them because they're classed as food, and therefore that's not funded on the NHS.
Mm.
It may depend. We are doing a trial at the moment. We just started a trial with the University of Bedfordshire, which I can talk to you about, which will give us more evidence. And, I think the tide might be changing, especially if you can show that a drug is more likely to be effective by supporting a patient with some supplements, I think the mood might change, and maybe they might start allowing us to supplement people's diets.
Yeah, well, it clearly needs to happen as the evidence arrives. I mean, there's no excuse really if a supplement works, is quite as good as a drug, or maybe even better in some circumstances. The justification for not paying for it simply because it's in a different class, it doesn't really hold water, does it?
No, but the whole rules of the MHRA, etc., would have to change. I can imagine the bureaucratic.
I can imagine.
Be tricky.
Okay, and just one quick question about. I mean, overall, you've mentioned a lot of things there. How much of the kind of advice that you're looking at there could somebody safely and reasonably self-medicate on the basis of some good reading or whatever, they actually found some good sources of information, and how much do you think they should be speaking to someone like a nutritional therapist or a functional medicine practitioner or yourself?
We're trying to get the message out to them, to oncologists, that if you're starting a medication which could cause arthritis, that they should be giving some preventative lifestyle advice. I mean, you've got to be careful what sites you look at. We've developed a site, or we have an ongoing site called keep-healthy.com,
okay,
which looks at lifestyle measures to prevent arthritis.
Okay.
We try to update it as more research is emerging.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, for things that we've just been talking about, and it summarizes it hopefully succinctly so people can look on that.
Right.
And, you know, most of it is not self-medicating. It's just doing healthy things.
Good lifestyle.
Yeah, you can talk. If you actually are starting a treatment for prostate cancer now,
yeah,
it's actually, we managed to get it onto NICE guidelines.
Wow.
That you should be referred for a 12-week exercise program.
Brilliant.
Not a lot of people know that, and okay, it's not happening as much as it should be, but a patient could actually demand quite, you know, easily from their medical team to be referred.
Oh, that's good.
Well, and in fact, if the medical team could get punished for not referring the patient, because it's
okay,
been NICE law now.
Okay, that's very good to know. If the patients don't get to hear this stuff, it could just be quietly forgotten about, can't it?
Yeah, it's supposed to be audited, and, you know, when a hospital is evaluated, if it's not been done, they can get their knuckles.
All right. Good.
What we are trying to do is get more evidence, as I said, for obvious reasons. So we're doing a trial with the University of Bedfordshire, which is randomizing men and women who are starting treatments which could cause arthritis. And we're randomizing them into a group which is having a polyphenol supplement,
right,
plus or minus a probiotic,
mm-hmm,
because we think there's synergy between those,
right,
or a placebo.
Mm-hmm.
And both groups would be giving an exercise program, whereas we get referred to the gym and given extra, you know, follow-up phone calls, asking them how they're doing, things to try and change their behavior so they,
yes,
become less sedentary.
Right.
And then at 4 months, we're measuring grip strength, a 6-minute walking test, and we're measuring joint pains, you know, with questionnaires,
mm-hmm,
and various other things like mood scale, level of hot flushes, etc., weight. So that's going to be a big study. That's going to be 200 patients,
200
externally audited,
right,
and that would be great, because if we can show that intervening before the arthritis develops, that would be a, you know, you asked why, you know, oncology departments aren't embracing this, but that,
right,
would be the type of thing which would change the behavior of oncologists. They like randomized trials, and
yeah,
they like,
of course they do.
You know,
yeah,
harder. And for that, we're using the POMI-T supplement plus the probiotic from keephealthy.com,
yeah,
because that's a British made one. It has all the five bacteria, which probably are the most important.
Mm-hmm.
We've got someone else to make the placebo.
Wow.
So that's quite exciting.
That's very exciting. Yeah. What's the overall period of the trial? When do you expect to have the results?
Well, not for a while, I'm afraid, Robin.
So it goes.
It's going to be, we want to try and get people who've just been started on cancer treatment, so the arthritis process isn't too advanced.
Yes.
So we have to wait till people are coming through. We can't just sort of put an advert out and everyone with a bit of joint pain on these treatments coming forward. But you know, it's these things take time. I mean, you know, we've done the 3 years of setting it up, which is the hardest part, and now
right,
we're getting into the actual recruiting patients and getting on with it. And I have to say, the University of Bedford is really keen, and I'm very pleased they're on board, because there's some bright young things there.
Excellent.
Excited about it.
Well, good for you. Sounds really good. Right, we're about out of time. Do you want to quickly tell people about the raft of resources that you've built up over time, what you've written, what you've got online?
There's no point in keeping all this information to yourself. Why I'm probably on this program. We've got the two websites. We've got the cancernet.co.uk, which is more sort of cancer related, and we've got the keep-healthy.com, which is more general health related.
I see.
So on that, we try to have a pictorial based system. So you click on joint pains and it'll give you the latest evidence for which lifestyle factors help. We've also now developed a blog with yourselves, actually, isn't it? We're making healthy recipes with anti-inflammatory, low-sugar foods, and that's on your blog as well as ours. It's on blog. cancernet.co.uk, but it's, I think it's on your Yes to Life it website is. As well.
Yeah, video blog.
So you can click on those and get good examples of foods which reduce inflammation, are generally healthy, and it shows people how to make them. You know, two lovely chefs who clearly describe how to make these recipes. And we, you know, have the usual Twitter and Facebook and stuff like that to try and keep people, you know, keep them informed, but also keep the process going. It's no point telling patients and friends once. You have to reinforce the message.
You do. It's a big learning process, isn't it? Yeah.
And we have the newsletter, which you can sign up through those websites, which every sort of maybe 4 or 5 times a year, we try to summarize the important issues which relate to our lifestyle and cancer.
Mm-hmm. Great. All right. Thank you so much, Professor Domus. That's really great. Been very interesting, and I have learned a lot about joint pain, and I had no idea it was such a big deal, so widespread, and clearly what you're doing is desperately needed. And I hope you managed to gain the attention of a, you know, wider audience of oncologists to get on with this stuff.
Well, yeah, well, good. Thanks for, you know, thanks for believing in our research and broadcasting what we do, because the more people who hear about it, as far as we're concerned, the better. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bye then. Bye.
Do connect with Professor Thomas's output of good quality lifestyle advice on social media and in his newsletters. Look on the Yes to Life website, that's yestolife.org.uk, and click the show logo that's on the homepage to find links to material mentioned in today's show. There are just a few places left on Yes to Life's Retreat and Restore Day at Bhaktivedanta Manor near Watford on the 22nd of June. It's the second one of these we've held, as the first was so successful. Look on the Yes to Life Facebook page or on the events page of the Yes to Life website, yestolife.org.uk, for full details and for booking. Details of this year's annual international conference have just gone online. Check the news feed on the Yes to Life website and also the Yes to Life newsletter, which has just gone out. By the way, if you're not already on the mailing list, be sure to sign up in the right-hand sidebar of the Yes to Life website. What has traditionally been a one-day event is this year being expanded to fill the entire weekend of the 30th November and the 1st of December. So be sure to block it out in your calendar. Tickets will be on sale shortly. Great to have you join me today. Please make a point of listening again next week. Goodbye.